obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hello, everyone. My name's Deb. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Deb.
Oh, it's an honor, and I'm going to leave that alone. It's an honor and a privilege to be here with you tonight. Thank you, Kristen and Carl and the committee for having me here. I met Kristen on an airplane when we were flying home, Kristen and Rob, when we were flying home from San Antonio from the World Conference 5 years ago. And I found out they were from Covina, so I asked them if they knew my friend Carl, and they said absolutely, and we had a little... I'm not that tall. Okay, so I can start all over. Anyway, we were on a flight back, and we were talking about our common friend Carl, and we were talking about this conference somehow came up, and I said, yeah, I lived in Southern California for a handful of years, and I never got to speak anywhere in Southern California. And I said, Carl doesn't even have me to his own conference, even though he's a really good friend of mine. So we were having a little bit of a laugh about that because Carl and I are really, really great friends. And so Carl called me and invited me to come to the Southern California Convention this year. And I was like, well, it's about time, sir. So I'm thrilled that I get to be here for the weekend. The audience is full of people that I know and love. And we got to play some great golf this morning, and it really is. It's a pleasure in my life to be here. So thank you so much for inviting me. It's a great event so far. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'm an alcoholic through and through. I'm absolutely an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1987, and for that I'm incredibly grateful. And class of 87. Woo-hoo. There we go. Anyway, so I'm going to do that to the best of my ability. I was born and raised in a really small town right outside of Akron, Ohio. The name of that little town was Rittman. There's a gentleman here who knows exactly where that was. He came and introduced himself to me before the meeting got started, and he and I actually got sober in the same town right outside of Akron, Ohio. In the little town where I grew up there, it was a town of about 5,000 people. And in that little town, everybody knew everybody else, and my dad was one of 9 kids, and I was related to over half the town. And it's really tough to get away with anything when you're related to half the town. But my dad's people, they all came out of the hills of West Virginia when the coal mines started to shut down. They moved over to Ohio to get the jobs in the factories, and so I came from good, solid Midwestern Union stock. I'm a blue-collar kid from the Midwest, and growing up in that kind of a blue-collar, real basic Midwestern environment, there are some things that I was taught that have just been completely invaluable to me. One of the things I learned in, growing up there was that if you can't pay cash for it, you don't need it. And that has really served me very, very well. I learned the value of money and the lack of value for things. And that's been invaluable. I'm an incredible patriot. I love the United States of America. I'm so incredibly grateful. I know we as a nation, we don't do everything right, but I'm just so incredibly grateful and proud to be an American. I really am. And that was something that was given to me from the time I was a tiny little girl, and I've been able to hold on to that. And I hold it very, very near and dear. Glenn and I, we just went to Cuba about a week and a half ago. We were able to align a trip down there so that we were able to be in the Pope's audience for Mass. And got to spend time in Cuba and in a communist nation and see what life is like when there's not enough, to go around. And again, I came home and I'm a bigger patriot today than I was yesterday. So those are a couple of the things that I learned growing up in that tiny little town, coming from the people who came right out of the hills of West Virginia as coal miners, and I'm so grateful for that. I also grew up in a household that was riddled, absolutely riddled, with a significant case of alcoholism. My dad has alcoholism. I believe that he was likely an alcoholic the day I was born. He'd been drinking for years before I came along. And so growing up in a house with alcoholism, I was taught a lot of things that since I've been a recovering alcoholic, I've had to hold up to the light and see if it had any value at all. You know, one of the things that I was taught was that if you want it done right, you do it yourself and you don't rely on anyone else. Okay, so in some areas of my life, that served me a little bit well for a little while, you know. But what that does is it just tells me that self-reliance is my answer, and what I know is that self-reliance today is not my answer. So that's one of those basic belief systems I had to hold up to the light and say, you know what, I'm going to have to let that one go. And yet I can't give up that kind of belief system if I don't have anything to replace it. And so thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God that this is a program that steers me toward the light and delivers me into the arms of God. Because there's no way that I could give up some of those belief systems and divorce myself from a really devastating level of self-reliance if that weren't the case. I told you that my dad had a severe case of alcoholism, and what that meant for me is that when I was growing up, I was a terrified little girl. I was scared of everything. I was scared of things that moved too fast. I was scared of loud noises. I was scared of shadows. I was scared of big people. I mean, there are noises that still today, when I hear them, the very sound will make the hair on the back of my neck stand up, and I'll sit up straight and I'll look around and make sure that everything's okay and I'm acting right. You know, one of those noises is the sound of rubber tires rolling down a gravel driveway. Because we had a long gravel driveway, and my dad was a very violent alcoholic, and we never knew what was coming home when he came home from work. And so growing up in a house with alcoholism, I was terrified of everything. And what I knew as I was watching my family, and I didn't have this language when I was a little kid, but what I knew was that if I was scared, I was going to be really vulnerable. But if I was angry, I was going to be really powerful. Because I watched my mom, and she was scared, and she was vulnerable all the time, and she got hurt a lot. And my dad was really angry, and he was very powerful, and it didn't look like anything hurt him. And I knew that I was terrified, but you know what? I didn't look terrified. My little shoulders were pinned to my ears, my hands were balled up in fists, and I looked angry, and I looked ready. I looked ready to take on anything that would come my way. And I ruled my neighborhood. I had a little posse when I was growing up. There was nothing happened in that neighborhood if they didn't run it by me first. I mean, we grew up where there was a lot of snow, and so we would make these sledding runs that went down through houses and around garages, and we'd hop a couple of streets here and there. And the sledding run, the layout of that run was a very big deal every time the first snow came. And nobody, absolutely nobody, put together that sledding run without running the route past me first. There wasn't a little dance routine that was choreographed in the neighborhood if I didn't approve of it. I mean, I ran everything. I had it locked down because I looked like I was in charge. I absolutely looked like I was in charge, and I was in charge. And still to this day, when I run into, there's a couple of people from my childhood that I'll run into from time to time, and they're like, wow, are you still as controlling as you used to be? And I'll be like, some days when I'm not spiritually fit. Yes, I absolutely am. So, but that's how I did things when I was a little kid, because I was so scared all the time, and I just wanted to be ready. And I'll tell you what, if you act angry long enough, you'll become angry. You will absolutely become angry. And I was one angry little kid. And I just wanted somebody, my own size to swing. You know, I would pick on other little kids. I was a bully to some extent among my peers. And I just wanted somebody to get angry enough to swing at me, because I wanted to swing back, and I wanted to hurt somebody. I just wanted to hurt somebody. And I didn't understand what was going on in my house. I didn't understand, of course, a thing about alcoholism. I didn't know that alcoholism robs families of love. I didn't know that alcoholism has the ability to rob children of security. I had no idea what was going on. I just knew that I was terrified, and then I got very, very angry. And I was mad at my mom for not doing something about my dad's temper, and I was mad at my dad for not loving me. I mean, I was just, it was absolutely something. And when I was 9 years old, I made a decision. I said, you know what, I'm going to find out what that stuff in those dark little bottles is, because I want to know, because it is absolutely ruling everything in our house, and I want to know what that stuff is. And when I would ask the adults in my life, what is that stuff and why is it so important, all they would ever say is that stuff's for adults and you don't need to know anything about it. You just stay away from it. But I knew it was really important. It was important to my dad that he drink it all day long, and it was really important to my mom that he have none of it. And there is a basic conflict of interest. And so when I was 9 years old, I said, you know what? If you're not going to tell me, I'm going to figure it out for myself. And that's how I've done things my entire life. So please, if I ask you a question this weekend, if you'll just stop and give me an answer, that would be great. Because if you don't, I'm going to go do research. And it may not always serve us well. So I went to do a little research on my own. My friend Tammy, her parents had a full bar in their basement. I spent the night over there one night, and I talked her into drinking with me. And we didn't know, you know, her parents, they would have people over, they would mix some drinks, they'd put on some music, they would have a couple of drinks, everybody would get happy, there'd be a little party in the basement. It just wasn't a big deal at their house. It was a take it or leave it attitude with alcohol. And that was not the case in my house. So when I talked her into drinking with me, she was like, well, sure. Like, it just wasn't a big deal to her. And we just started picking bottles off the bar based on their label. I was 9. I picked a bottle of Christian Brothers. I used to say that it was Christian Brothers whiskey. And then I was given a talk like this, and Sister Maurice was in the audience, and she reared back out loud, and she said, honey, that's brandy. And I was like, well, leave it to the religious to know their booze. But anyway, we were just picking bottles off the bar, and we were just taking swigs out of the bottles to see if any of it was worth swallowing. And eventually I was able to swallow enough to where the magic of alcohol happened for me for the very first time. The magic of drunkenness, the magic of relief. You know, it was a night of firsts for me. It was my first drink, my first drunk, my first blackout. The next day was my first hangover. But what I can tell you is that it is the very first time that I could remember where I had complete freedom from fear. That's what alcohol did for me. It gave me the relief that I didn't know that I needed. And my shoulders came off my ears, and my hands let loose, and I exhaled for the first time. And I thought, oh my gosh, if this is what alcohol does for my dad, no wonder he drinks all the time. I mean, who wouldn't? This stuff is magic. This stuff is absolute magic. It gave me relief for the very first time. And I didn't know I needed relief. I had no idea. But the next day, I was a little worried that there were some things that were really fuzzy to me that I wasn't quite able to recall. But I remember that feeling of relief, and it was so crystal clear. And I made a decision that very next day, even though I was sick and I was hungover, and I said, you know what, I'm going to drink as much of this stuff as often as I can. I wanted that feeling of relief so much. And so that's what I did. I set out to drink as much alcohol as often as I could. And I started to reevaluate every relationship in my life at that point. If your parents had a bar, you were in my inner circle. If you had older brothers and sisters who got a little sloppy with where they left their bottles and we could get to it and steal it, you were kind of inner circle, outer ring. You know, if your parents were teetotalers and you didn't drink at all and you were real straight-laced, I'd hang out with you at school, but that's as far as this relationship was going to go. You know, you weren't worth my extracurricular time. So if you increased my access to alcohol, you came in very close to me. And if you didn't increase my access to alcohol, I wasn't going to have a whole lot to do with you. And that's just the way that went. And so I really set out to get as much alcohol in my system as I could as often as possible because I really wanted that feeling of relief. And what that did for me was that it enabled me to drink my way into my own case of alcoholism by the time I was 14 and 15 years old. Because I chased it down. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know I was drinking my way into this illness. I had no idea. What I knew was that when I drank enough, I got an overwhelming feeling of relief, and I could exhale, and I was absolutely free from fear. And so by the time I was a sophomore in high school, I was unable to draw a sober breath. The last 6 to 8 months of my drinking or so are really very, very fuzzy to me. I don't remember much of it at all. What I do know is that I was drinking around the clock. I would wake up in the morning and I would have to have something to drink just to calm myself down and make it to school. I would have to drink a little bit throughout the day just to be able to sit still in my classes. I would drink after school. And we lived right on the railroad tracks in this little town. And on one side of the railroad tracks, that's not where you wanted to live, because it was a very, very poor area. There was a lot going on the wrong side of the tracks that, you know, good girls weren't supposed to know anything about. And we lived on the first block on the other side of the tracks. And there was a dark little house on the wrong side of the tracks, and that's where people who came to our little town to work in the railroad industry, people came to our little town who needed to stay off the radar. and be really quiet, and they would live in this dark little house on the wrong side of the tracks. And I found out where that house was, and that house was full of people who thought that it was perfectly fine to buy a 14 or a 15-year-old her own fifth of vodka every single day and not ask any questions. Because I had fallen into this cycle where I drank a lot, and I drank a lot every single day. And when you're 14 and 15 years old, and there's no job, and there's no money, and there's no way to buy your own booze, you've got to get really, really creative. And so my creativity took me to the wrong side of the tracks, and I would go there more and more often. And that last several months of my drinking before I ended up in a treatment center in downtown Cleveland, I was crossing the tracks every single day. And what happened for me is that by the time I ended up finally getting caught, I had been unable to look in the mirror to brush my hair or brush my teeth because I was so ashamed of who I was. I was unable to sleep because every time I closed my eyes, I would just relive the things that had happened to me when I was drinking or in a state of, you know, complete drunkenness. The amount of shame that I carried day in and day out was completely overwhelming. And I finally got caught. My parents had gotten a divorce. It was really simple. My dad was a very, very violent man, and my sister and I had sat my mom down at one point, and we'd said, "Look, you know, you got to get us out of here. You know, we're little kids. We can't leave here without you." And so my mom had divorced my dad. They had the longest divorce case in Wayne County history, because, you know, my dad wasn't going to let anything go easily, even though he really didn't want kids. You know, I remember when my sister and I were really little. I was 5 or 6, and so she was 6 or 7 years old. She's 2 years older than I am. We were sitting at the little kid table in the corner of the kitchen, and my parents were having a fight because my mom had spent some money for us for school clothes, and they were arguing, and I remember my dad just looked at us and he pointed at us and he said, "You know, I don't know why you spend money on those kids. They're never going to amount to anything anyway." And I remember looking at my sister, and my sister just took that message on board, and she just kind of folded in on herself, and she believed every word of it. And I remember looking at him, and I was thinking, how can somebody so big be so wrong? And so my mom, we sat her down, and she finally decided that she was going to leave my dad. We all fell into abject poverty, and my mom had to get a couple of jobs, and she worked really, really hard just to pay the rent. Keep the roof over our head and keep food in our stomachs. And it was a pretty rough way to go. And so I'm drinking and my sister's doing drugs and my mom's going through this enormous divorce, and we were all just an absolute wreck. We really were. And I finally got caught. My mom went out of town. She finally got a boyfriend who would do things like take her out on dates and pay the check. And and so he was taking her out of town to do something wonderful, and my sister and I decided that instead of staying where we were supposed to stay and be safe, that we shot a couple of angles and we stayed there at the house, and we had the people from the wrong side of the tracks. We thought, you know what, if we have them come to us rather than going to them, we'll be a little bit safer. And so we had them come over, and everything went off the rails, and the police were called, and there were, you know, the people were arrested, and my sister and I were in a big jam, and she went to juvenile jail, and it was just an enormous mess in that tiny little town of 5,000 people. And my mom came home, and she found me completely passed out because I had been drinking my own fifth of Jack Daniels that night, and somebody had, you know, mentioned that they didn't think that I could drink the entire thing, and I said I absolutely could. And so I drank that all, and I fell into a drunken stupor, and that's what she walked in on, and everything in that little town just exploded. And Monday morning came, and I went to school, and I was in all kinds of trouble, and I had been, you know, grounded forever, and like I said, the cops had been called, and they were looking for those people who had come and brought those things into our home. And the people that had warrants out for their arrest, they weren't great people, and so I thought, you know what, I just need to get out of town. And but I didn't know which way out of town was. You know, I didn't drive. I didn't have any money. We didn't leave town for much. But I knew that I needed to get out of town, and I needed to get some distance from the situation. And when I went to school on Monday morning, the guidance counselor called me in, and she said, "What in the world happened?" You know, and so I told her some lies and spun some new truths. And I ended up telling her, I said, you know, my dad was the town drunk, and everybody knew that. And so I ended up telling her, I said, you know, I've had a little something to drink a couple of times. Now, I've been drinking every single day. I'd been unable to draw a sober breath. And I said, I've had a little something to drink a couple of times, and it's not going very well. And there had been a young girl in my school who had been sent away to downtown Cleveland, to Glen Bay Hospital, to get an inpatient adolescent assessment for alcoholism and drug addiction. She was in there for 10 days. They figured out that she wasn't an alcoholic, she wasn't a drug addict, and so they sent her back, and everybody forgave her, and they felt sorry for her because she'd been away at a hospital. And I thought, man, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. I need to get out of town. 10 days ought to about do it. By the time the 10 days is over, nobody's going to be angry with me anymore. They're actually going to feel sorry for me when I come back home. This is awesome. And so I tell the counselor, I said, maybe I need to get one of those assessment things. And she said, well, honey, do you think it's that bad? And I said, no, it probably isn't. But, you know, I should probably have that assessment anyway, because, you know, they say alcoholism runs in families. I had learned a little something. And, you know, if this is it, we should probably nip this in the bud. And she said, well, okay, honey. And so she said, I can get you in there tonight. And I said, well, tonight? I mean, that's quick. And she said, well, yes, but I can get you in there tonight. And I said, well, Thanksgiving's coming up. You know, why don't we wait until after Thanksgiving? It's only a couple of weeks away. And she said, okay, all right, Thanksgiving then. And so we waited. I had 2 weeks because I had affairs to get in order. Now, I don't know what affairs a 15-year-old has to get in order, but I had affairs to get in order. And so I took that 2 weeks and I did research on alcoholism treatment, on Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wanted to know what I was getting myself into so that I could be prepared. Because what I knew was that I drank a lot, and that if I told them the truth, that wasn't going to be good. So I kind of needed to figure out where my threshold was and what I needed to tell them when I got there. And so I was trying to figure you people out and trying to figure out what this AA thing was about. There was an adult who lived behind us, and I ran into him, and I said, look, I said, and this is a guy that I used to drink with, and he used to get me lots and lots of booze. And I ran into him, and he said, what's going on? He's like, man, you know, the streets are just buzzing. You know, people are going to jail. People are hiding. You know, this thing that happened at the house over the weekend is not good. And I said, put out the word. I'm being punished, and I'm being sent away to a hospital. And he said, okay. And I said, he said, where are you going? And I said, Glen Bay. And he said, oh, he said, I just got out of that place. And I said, well, what's it like? And so he gave me the lowdown on treatment. So I knew exactly what I needed to do to prepare for this thing. And I said, well, I said, so here's the deal. The counselors sleep at night, right? And he said, no, but there's not very many of them. And I said, well, that's great. I said, because when I sneak out at night, you know, I need to be able to figure out how to do this. And he said, that adolescent unit is locked. And I said, it's locked? And he said, yeah. I said, when you get in there, you're not coming home. You're not leaving. Because I had a plan, you see. I had been drinking nonstop, and I was completely unable to draw a sober breath. When I stopped drinking, I had to withdraw from alcohol. I remember hearing my mom, she was talking to her sister on the phone one day, and she said, you know, she said, I'm really worried about Deb because she has the flu a lot. Because when I would need to sober up to get something done, it would take me 2 or 3 days to sober up, and I felt like and looked like I had the flu. The withdrawal for me was very, very significant. And I just wasn't all that interested in being sober. I really wasn't. For me, the only relief that I had from the visions that I had in my head and from revisiting all the memories from the things that had happened to me, from revisiting the place on the wrong side of the tracks, that dark little house, and from reliving all of that, you know, blow by blow, day by day, the only relief I had from that was absolute drunkenness. And so when you sobered me up, all you had was a young alcoholic who had absolutely no coping skills. You know, I had no God, I had no program, I had no relief, I had nothing. And so being sober, I just really wasn't all that interested in it. And this whole 10 days in Glen Bay Hospital thing, you know, I thought certainly I would be able to get out of there, and I would sneak out, I would drink at night, I would take the edge off, I would come back in and do what you needed me to do during the day, and I would sneak back out and drink at night and come back in and do what you needed me to do during the day. That's the pattern I had, and I thought, I'm just going to take that into that hospital with me. And when he told me that there was no getting out of there and that they locked that unit, I had to come up with a different plan. And so I decided that I wasn't going to go to treatment, and that I was just going to drink as much as I could, and what I was going to try to do is just drink myself to death, because to me that seemed like the most reasonable thing to do. And so I went on a run unlike any other run, and I came to in downtown Cleveland in Glen Bay Hospital 3 days after I had checked in. I'd walked in there in a complete blackout, and they didn't believe that adolescents needed medical detox at the time, so they just put me in a set of pajamas and put me in a room where everything was locked down, and they just let me shake, rattle, and roll, and go through my own detox. And it took me the majority of that full 10 days. It took me the majority of that 10 days to fully detox. And what I found out when I came out of that blackout is that they had done my assessment when they took me in there, and I was going to tell them that I had had a little something to drink a couple of times. And what I ended up telling them was the absolute truth. So by the time I came out of that blackout, I had a full chart, and on the front of that chart, they already had the word alcoholic stamped right on the front of it. And what I had also done was I had told them everything that my sister had been doing. So they called my sister, or they called my mom at home, and they said, you know, you got another one. And my mom said, you got to be kidding. And they said, no, let us get this one through the 10-day inpatient assessment, and as soon as we get her downstairs to treatment, you can bring in the other one. And so I got my clothes and I went downstairs to start my treatment program, because clearly they weren't going to let me go home. And when I got down there, they had called a code over the loudspeaker, and all of the counselors, they were loosening their ties and rolling up their sleeves, and they were running back upstairs to the unit where I had just come from. And I stopped one of them and I said, what's going on? And they said, your sister's here. And it seems that they had tricked my sister. They said, don't you want to go visit Deb? Because my sister and I were less than 2 years apart in age, and we looked alike, and we were running buddies. I mean, we were serious road dogs. I mean, any kind of trouble that she got in, I got in, and vice versa. We had each other's backs. We were running scams. We were doing all of that stuff together. And so we hadn't seen each other for 10 days. And so she came to the hospital to visit me because they said that they were going to keep me longer. So she gets in there and she walks up to that unit and the door closes behind her and it locks, and they throw her a set of pajamas and tell her she's staying. And she tore that place apart. Tore that place apart. So I find out that my sister's upstairs, and I'm like, oh, thank goodness. So I have to wait 10 days for my sister to come down to start her treatment program, because I don't know that I have told them the truth about what she's been up to. You see, I was drinking around the clock, and my sister was doing drugs every day. And so she was after it really, really hard. So I knew if they kept me, they were certainly keeping her too. So 10 days later, she comes down with with her clothes to start her additional 20 days of treatment. I go running up to her because I haven't seen her in 20 days now. And I went to hug her, and she looked at me and she said, don't go to sleep. So I spent the last 20 days in treatment wide awake, with my sister incredibly angry with me. And this is how I did treatment. I listened as little as I could. I learned as little as I could. I avoided every direct question. I pointed blame and focus. I kept it on other people the entire time. When my mom would come in for family group, she and I would gang up on other families, just to make sure that the focus was always on them. And I did absolutely nothing to learn how to recover from a disease of alcoholism. I did absolutely nothing. And so when it was time for me to get out, and here's the thing in treatment. I was completely sober in treatment because they kept me on that adolescent unit and they kept it locked. So I'm completely sober, and I don't want to be sober. I have no interest in being sober, because when I'm sober, I am far more than restless, irritable, and discontented. When I'm sober, I'm angry, I'm scared, and I'm ashamed. I'm angry, I'm scared, and I'm ashamed. And all I want is to get out of this place and to have a drink. That's all I want. I just want a drink. I wish everybody would stop overreacting. And you know what they do to you in treatment? They talk. They talk nonstop. It's group therapy, it's individual therapy, it's lessons, it's meetings, it's just talking, 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 talking. And I was like, I wish you people would just shut up and give me a drink. And they just kept talking. And so by the time my 20 days is up, I had my exit interview and they said, well, what did you learn? And I said, I learned that you people are finally gonna shut up. I just need to get out of here and have a drink. That bought me an extra 10 days in treatment. It seemed that I was a risk for failure on their statistics. By the time I got out of there, my sister had also earned some extra days. My sister caught me when I was getting on the elevator, and it was the first time she had talked to me since we'd been in treatment, because she blamed me for being in there, and I guess it was my fault. But she grabbed me when I was getting on the elevator, and she said, "You don't drink until I get out of here." She said, "You go get my stuff, and you go get a bottle, but you will wait. You will not be out there drinking while I'm in this place because of you." And I was like, "Fine, fine, fine." And I have no idea why I did, but I went home and I got her stuff and I got me bottles and I waited for 10 more days for my sister to get home from treatment. It was the longest 10 days of my life. But I waited for her because I wanted her to forgive me. And when she rolled in after that 10 days, I went and I met her at the car and I took her upstairs and I lifted the floorboard and I showed her everything that we had and I said, "Tonight is the night we are finally gonna relapse. I have been waiting on this." And she said, "Well, they called it a spiritual experience." I said, "Who?" She said, "The counselors. I had a thing and they said it was a spiritual experience." And I said, "No, it wasn't." She said, "Yes, it was a spiritual experience and we're going to stay sober." And I said, "No, we're not going to stay sober. I'm done with sober." And she said, "No, we're going to be sober and we're going to AA. I said, "AA? You don't even drink." She said, "I know, but they said NA sucks. I have to go to AA." So off we went to AA. And here's how we went there. My mom would drop us off. 15 minutes before the meeting started, my cool card was officially gone. We would stand outside. We would smoke cigarettes. We would try to get dates. I didn't even smoke, but I learned. We would smoke long enough to be late getting into the meeting. And then when we would go into the church basement into the meeting, we would walk in, we would walk right up the middle, we would make as much noise as we could. All of the chairs were the metal folding chairs and we had concrete floors in our church basement, so we'd drag the chairs across the floor so they'd bang and make lots of noise. I didn't even like coffee, but I had 3 cups at every meeting, up, down, up, down, up, down. I was a complete and utter disruption to every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I went to because I didn't want to be there. I absolutely didn't want to be there. I was 15 years old, and I figured I was going to make it your fault that I was there. And when you people would circle up to pray at the end of the meeting, I didn't get in your circle. I absolutely was not getting in your circle, because here's the deal. I don't know the words of the Lord's Prayer, and you're not going to pull my punk card like that. So you people would start to circle up. I would get up. I would slide down the back wall, and I would leave through the door through which I came, and I would get out of there before the prayer started. And I was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Akron area. They take their AA a little seriously in the Akron area. They were very unhappy with our behavior in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very unhappy. The president of Alcoholics Anonymous, his name was Mac Shadburn. And Mac Shadburn, he was the guy that ran the greeting gauntlet. When you walked into the meeting on time, you would have to walk through past him and all his guys, and they would shake your hand as you went in, and they would greet you. And if you didn't look quite right, they'd pull you in real close, and they'd go, and if you didn't smell quite right, you disappeared into a side room with a couple of guys. And I didn't know what happened in the side room, but I wasn't real interested in finding out either. And one evening, I am sliding down the wall because I can tell by the tempo of your meetings that you're getting ready to pray, and so I'm on my way out. And I run into something. And I turn and I look up, and there's Mac Shadburn, and he's standing like this, and he's right in the door. And he just looked at me, and he said, "Get in the circle." And I looked at him, and I went and I got in the circle. And I bowed my head really low so that my hair would cover my face so that you wouldn't know that I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. And as soon as that prayer was over, I was back to that door, and Mac had not gotten in the circle. He was still standing in the doorway. And he just looked at me and he said, "Are you alcoholic?" And I gave him the only answer that I had. And he said, "Can you control your drinking?" And I thought, my God, you people are obsessed with controlling your drinking. I mean, there are entire meetings about ways to control your drinking that you had tried and failed. I was just like, why would you try to control your drinking? I mean, there's a bottle, you take the cap off, you throw the cap away, you drink it all, and you hope to God it's enough. Right? This control your drinking, what am I going to do? Go have two drinks and take the edge off? Like, that's not enough. I don't understand this. But he said, "Can you control your drinking?" And so I said, and he handed me $5 and he said, "Here's $5. Go find out. We are tired of you treating Alcoholics Anonymous like a joke." And I went and I got my sister and I was like, "Go get your $5. We're out of here." I mean, woohoo! I was like, that's all I've been wanting is somebody with some authority to give me permission to go take a drink so that I could get the feeling of relief that I needed. Because here was the deal. I'd been sober like 4 months, physical sobriety with no recovery. I was absolutely miserable, and I was making everybody around me miserable, and I needed some relief. My shoulders were back on my ears. My hands had been balled up in fists. I hurt all the time, and I just wanted some relief. And finally, the president of Alcoholics Anonymous told me I could go drink. I'm like, this is awesome. This is great. And so my sister, I had been working on her from the outside, and her illness had been working on her from the inside, and I was like, come on, it's time. And so she and I, we went back out and we relapsed. And I'm so incredibly grateful that I did. Because here, Mac looked at me and he said, "I want you to go find out." And he said, "Here's the deal. If it doesn't work, you get back here. If it does work, if you can control your drinking, and it works, I never want to see you again." And so I had my formula. I was going to have 3 shots and 2 beers. To me, that was very moderate. I just wanted enough to get my shoulders off my ears. So 3 shots and 2 beers, very, very moderate. So I went out and I had my 3 shots and 2 beers. That would lead you to believe I used a glass. There's no shot glasses in how I drink. So I took 3 long pulls off of the bottle and had a couple of beers. And I sat there and I waited to see what the effect would be. And my shoulders came off my ears just a little bit, and my hands let loose just a little bit. And I sat there for a minute and I thought, you know what? I think my equation was just a little off. I'm not going to drink to oblivion. I'm not going to drink that way, and I'm not going to cross the tracks. I'm not going to go back there again. I'm not going to hang out with those people who hurt me. None of that's going to happen to me again. But I think my equation was just a little bit off. So I had another shot and another beer and another shot and another beer and another shot and another beer, because here's the deal. I have alcoholism, and the more I drink, the thirstier I get. The more I drink, the thirstier I get. The phenomena of craving kicked in, and I was off and running. And the next day, I came to after having a blackout. I'm a huge blackout drinker. I came out of that blackout, and I was black and blue, and I was filthy. I hurt all over, and I was incredibly sick. I had no idea what had happened to me. I knew that my 3 shots and 2 beers wasn't enough. And I don't know when I stopped. And what I heard was Mac Shadburn's voice in my head that said, "If it doesn't work, you get back here." And that day I went back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got there on time. I sat in the middle. I only had 1 cup of coffee. And when you people circled up, I got in your stupid circle.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And when the prayer was over and I went to leave that room, I walked back to that door and Mac Shadburn was standing back in that doorway again. And he just looked over top of those little glasses at me and he said, "Did you get a sponsor?" And I looked at him and I said, "No." And he said, "You get a sponsor before you leave this room, young lady." And the queen of Alcoholics Anonymous, her name was Jane. And Jane had been sober since Christ was a child. And Jane had her own parking place out back. And there was a newcomer that would drive Jane to the meeting. And when she would get there, somebody would yell out and they'd say, "Jane's here." And there'd be four newcomers would go grab this wooden high back chair. They'd carry it out car side and they would load Jane into this chair. And they would carry her down the stairs into the church basement like the Pope rolling through the mall. And they would carry her across and they would put her at her appointed position, which is right where Kristen is sitting, right there in front of the podium. She got the only crystal ashtray in the joint. The rest of us were using those metal ones. And she would sit there at every meeting, and she had this white hair and it was pulled back in a bun and there was a glow around her and she smoked cigarettes on an extender. And everybody loved Jane. They just loved her. And she loved everybody, and she knew something significant about everyone's lives, and she acted like everybody mattered, and I hated her. I hated her. I stayed as far away from her as I could always stay. And Jane was sitting there, and Max said, "You go find a sponsor before you leave this room." I asked every woman in that room, and every woman in that room said, "No, no, honey, no, no." And they didn't even offer excuses like, "No, I'm too busy. No, I sponsor too many. No, I just had a baby. No, I work too." I mean, there were no excuses. It was just, "No, no, uh-uh." And so I went to leave the room and Mac was still standing there and he said, "Well, did you get a sponsor?" And I said, "No one in here will sponsor me." And he said, "That's a lie." And I said, "I'm not asking her." And he said, "Yes, you are." And I said, "No, sir." And he just took his finger and he went. And so I walked up to where Jane was sitting and I was like, "Oh my God, my life is really over." And I waited my turn to talk to her because she always had people lined up because she was so lovely. And I waited my turn to talk to her. And when I got up close to her, I just looked at her and I said, "Will you sponsor me?" And she took a drag off that cigarette extender. And she said, "Oh, honey, why should I?" It was a fair question. It was a fair question. And instead of telling her where to shove that cigarette extender, which was my plan, what I said was, "Because I need to be sober and I don't know how." And I thought, "Who said that?" And she said, "Well, in that case, I guess you'll be doing some things differently now, won't you?" And she gave me the list of everything I was no longer going to be doing in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and the things I was going to be doing in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and how many pages in that big book I was going to be reading and all of that. And I took my list and I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I left. And I was like, "Oh my God, I have really just turned my will and my life over to a 75-year-old woman. This is not good." And the next day, I'm sitting there after school, and I'm doing homework, and I'm just absolutely, my life is over as far as I'm concerned. And there's this enormous, do you guys remember the Ford LTDs from the 70s? Do you remember how big those things were? And they had great big steering wheels, and you could steer them with one finger. And like, if you wanted to make a turn, you had to start making that turn half a block back, you know, because the car kind of had to consider the request. And they would float around the curves, and when they came to a stop, they would stop, but they'd kind of have to do this deal. Because like the car was too big for the chassis or something. One of those cars comes floating in the driveway about 7 o'clock, and my ma said, "Honey, who's that?" And I said, "I have no idea, I'll go find out." So I walked out to the car and there's two old men sitting in the car, and I knock on the window and they roll the window down and they're smoking cigarettes and listening to country music and drinking coffee and laughing about something. And I said, "Can I help you?" And they said, "Jane sent us, get in the car." And I said, "No, I'm good. I went to a meeting yesterday," and they said, "Jane sent us, get in the car." And I walked in the house and I was like, "Ma, AA's here." And she said, "Okay, honey, have fun." And I was like, "You gotta be kidding me." And she said, "No, go ahead." And I went out and I got in the back seat of this Ford LTD. Now that you could fit 12 newcomers in the back seat of one of these things. So I get in the back seat of this car and off we go to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get there and there's nobody there. And you know why there's nobody there? Because we're there to set up the meeting. I'm not only having to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but now I got to set the freaking thing up. I'm busy. But we go in and we set up all the tables and chairs, and I have to make, you know, coffee in a coffee pot that's this tall, and I'm just doing everything that I'm told, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, this is what my life is now. This is it. And I sit in this meeting, and it's a speaker meeting in Barberton, Ohio on a Monday night, and there's white hair row. Everybody with white hair sits along this one row down the wall, and that's where the speaker's inventory gets taken. And in meetings in Northeast Ohio, they do this thing where you get up and you give your pitch. And then afterwards, they open the floor for comment. It generally goes well, sometimes not so much. And I sit through this meeting, and as soon as the meeting is over and we help stack the chairs and clean the coffee pots and do the whole thing, I'm back in the back seat of that Ford LTD. And for some reason, we're not going toward my house. We're going somewhere else. And I was like, hey, fellas, am I live the other way? And they're like, mm-hmm. And here's the deal. Not only did I have to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with them, but then I had to go to the freaking donut shop. And you know what they talk about at the donut shop? Everything they just talked about at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So not only do I have to sit through it one time, now I have to sit through it a second time, and I didn't understand it the first time, so I have no input, and I just would rather go home. But I'm sitting at the donut shop, and they buy me a cup of coffee and a donut and let me bum as many cigarettes as I want. And I sit there and I listen to them rehash everything that happened at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I get to go home. And Tuesday comes, and guess what happens? There's the car again. Two different old guys sitting in my driveway at 7 o'clock. I walked out and I was like, what are you guys doing? And they said, Jane sent us, get in the car. And I was like, I've been to two meetings in a row. I'm good. Like, I get a night off. And they said, there's no night off. Get in the car. And I get in the car, and we're off to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm making coffee and setting up chairs and cleaning ashtrays and washing coffee cups, and for the love of God, can you people just leave me alone? And after the meeting's over, guess where we get to go? To the donut shop, where I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking coffee and eating donuts and smoking cigarettes till midnight. I'm 15. I'm a sophomore in high school. Take me home. But I don't get to go home because here's the deal. Max Shadburn had called an emergency group conscience meeting when my sister and I were going to meetings and acting badly. And he said, we got to figure out what we're going to do about these youngins. They're ruining Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to throw them out. And everybody in the meeting was like, yes, we got to get rid of them. They're late. They're disruptive. They're up and down. They're just miserable. They don't know what they're doing. They're probably not even alcoholic. So they were going to throw us out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Mac was going to get to do the honors. And everybody was happy. And there was, for those of you in service, there was a minority voice in the room. His name was Bill Long. And Bill Long was an old, old, old man who said nothing ever. And he was sitting in the back of the room, and he said, well, the way I see it, God gave them to us, therefore they're our responsibility. I think we have to put them on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and give them a shot. And the room turned on a dime. And if Bill Long hadn't been the minority voice in the room and hadn't said it out loud, you'd have a different speaker tonight. And they said, well, what are we going to do with them? Because we can't let them continue to act like this. And Max said, well, it says in the book that if you don't know whether or not you're alcoholic, you should go try some controlled drinking. So let me make that suggestion to them. And they said, well, all right, you can do that. And then one of the guys says, but what are we going to do if they come back? Somebody's going to have to sponsor them. And another man in that room said, I have a feeling that these girls are very damaged, and the people that have hurt them have been young people and people their parents' age. I think if these girls are going to have a shot, us old folks are going to have to take them on. And they said, well, all right. And they looked at Jane, and Jane said, I don't have enough energy to sponsor those girls. And they said, Jane, you're going to have to take them. And if you'll take them on, we'll all help. So I had a Monday crew, a Tuesday crew, a Wednesday crew, a Thursday crew, a Friday crew, a Saturday crew, and a Sunday crew. Every night of the week, there was one of those big old cars in my parking lot waiting for me to just get in the car. And they would take me to the donut shop, and we would take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with me at the donut shop, page by page, line by line. And when it said, do this, we did it. And they put me onto the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a God squad, and I had an inventory crew. I mean, they had specialty areas. And as I'm working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm spending increased time with these old folks, my life is getting better. And I'm starting to feel that relief that I was looking for when I was drinking, the relief that I was no longer getting because I had the disease of alcoholism. It just wasn't working. But I started to feel that relief. And there, all of a sudden, one day, I realized that I was breathing, and I was inhaling all the way and exhaling all the way. And that my shoulders that used to be pinned to my ears were no longer all the way on my ears anymore, and they were halfway down. And when I sat with them, and when I did that inventory work, and I wrote all that stuff down on paper, and I took that stuff to Jane, and I went over that stuff with her. When I sat down with her, she said, I want you to tell me the thing that you didn't write down. And I said, no, I was fearless and thorough. And she said, I want you to tell me the thing you didn't write down. And so I led with the chin, and I told her the thing that I didn't write down. And she said, see, that wasn't so bad, was it? And she enabled me to unpack all that shame through the process of the fourth and fifth step. And I would take all of my programs to the donut shop. Every problem I had, I would take it to the donut shop, and I would hand it over to these men who had put me on the program. And you know, and I'm 15, 16 years old, and so everything's a big deal. Very high drama. And I would take it to the donut shop, and I would unload it there. And my God squad, there was this one guy, and he had the same question for me every single night. Did you pray about it? 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 And then finally one day I just looked at him, and I said, I don't know how. And he said, give me your book. So I slid the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, across the table, and I said, there. And he opened it up, and he took a highlighter and a pen, and he underlined and highlighted every one of the tiny little prayers that's in the pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He closed it, he slid it back, and he said, pick one and try it. You see, because I wasn't raised in a household where we prayed, we didn't talk about God, we didn't go to church, we had no spiritual energy in that house whatsoever, none. So I didn't know how to pray, I didn't know the words of the Lord's Prayer, I didn't know the Serenity Prayer, I didn't know any of that. I learned all of that by going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing what I was told. And so when he pointed out to me that there were prayers in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and slid that book across the table and said, pick one out and try it, he also said, on your knees. And so that night, for some reason, I listened to these guys. And that night I went home and I opened up that big book on the side of my bed. I got on my knees and I read one of those prayers with one eye open because I wanted to get the words just right. And I started to pray. And I just continued to pray, and I continued to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I continued to hang out in that stupid donut shop. And my life got better, and I got lighter, and forgiveness came into my life, and I began to build a relationship with God. You see, I chose to believe in God because these old guys believed in God, and they would sit at the donut shop, and they would tell me their stories. They would tell me their stories of incredible drunkenness and incredible restoration. They would tell me the stories. Like one guy, he hadn't been invited to Sunday dinner at his daughter's house for 16 years. 16 years, and he'd been sober for 12 years. And finally she called and she invited him over to Sunday dinner and allowed him to meet his grandkids. And he brought that story to the donut shop before dinner. because he wanted to make sure he got some input and that he acted right. And I got to hear their stories, and I got to watch their lives get put back together. And some of these men had been the kind of alcoholic that my dad had been. And their kids wouldn't talk to them because of the kind of alcoholic they had been. And so they parented me instead. And I got to heal some of those wounds, and they got to heal some of those wounds. And those things didn't happen in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They happened at the donut shop over a cup of coffee and a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was 2.5 years sober, I finally graduated from high school. And they said, you know, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, you know, I think I'm going to get a job at Rubbermaid. That was a big company in our town. I said, I think I'm going to get a job at Rubbermaid. And they just looked at me and they said, no, you're not. And I said, well, why not? I said, then we can play euchre at lunch. I mean, you know, it's a card game that we played a lot of. I was like, we can all sit around and play euchre at lunch. And they said, you're going to go to college. And I said, no, I'm good. I'm good. And they said, no, you're going to go to college. You see, when I went into treatment, I had a 3.8 grade point average. I was president of my class, and I was playing 3 varsity sports. 2.5 years later, when I graduated from high school, I was playing no sports at all. My grades had dropped. I was skipping school and going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get rigorously honest right away. And I just wasn't all that interested in school anymore. I just wanted to stay there, and I wanted to hang out with these old guys, and I wanted to be safe and cared for, because, you know, I don't think that I would have stayed on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous if at some point I didn't come to believe that those men really loved me. If they hadn't taken such good care, if they hadn't shown up when they said they were going to show up and put me in the back seat of that car night after night, day after day, if they hadn't been consistent, I don't think I would have stayed on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's what they gave me. So I wasn't interested in leaving them, and they said, no, go get all that paperwork you're going to need to apply to college and meet us at the donut shop. And I went to the guidance counselor, and I got all the paperwork, and I met him at the donut shop, and we sat there. Now, none of these guys had ever been to college. Most of them had not graduated from high school. And we sat there, and we looked at all these papers, and we just went through it line by line like we did the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would ask me questions, and they would fill out college applications for me. And at one point, they were like, well, how much money does your mom make? And I said, well, I don't know. And they go, well, hell, it can't be much. And we filled out all this paperwork, and we sent it away. And before I knew it, I had been accepted to colleges all over the state of Ohio, and my test scores were fine. And so I took all the acceptance letters to the donut shop, and I was like, what am I supposed to do? And they were like, well, that one's too far away. That one's too far away. This one's about 2 hours. I think that'll be good. Because you got to get out of town, but not so far that you don't come home. And so I was allowed to go to that school. And so they packed my stuff, and they bought me things for my dorm room, and they shuffled me off to college, and I left the nest. And they also taught me how to reestablish the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in a different place. And I went there, and they said, go to the same meetings every single week. He said, and when you go to a meeting and they remember your name, go back and make that one your home group. And so I learned how to move from place to place and how to reestablish a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, standing here today, I've been sober since 1987. I'm sober 28 and a half years. I've moved 11 times in my adult life. I've made all of the moves. Most of them were career-oriented moves. And I live in hotels most of the time. I'm in tiny little towns, and I'm all over the place. And I know how to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous no matter where I go. I know how to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I see familiar faces sitting in that room or not. I know how to do this deal. You see, the foundation that they gave me sitting in those donut shops across Northeast Ohio is completely unshakable. The foundation that they gave me and the relationship with God that they gave me has really seen me through some very, very big and tough times. Really has. And it's also seen me through the normal, average, mundane days that sometimes make us more fidgety than the days when things are going wrong. That foundation that they gave me is the foundation that I stand here on today. I got sober on the shoulders of giants, and most of them were not famous in an anonymous program. They were blue-collar guys who went to work every day and did exactly what they said they were going to do when they said they were going to do it. And they loved me sober. They absolutely loved me sober because they believed that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked. They just believed it. And I was able to heal from a very, very bad case of alcoholism. You know, I stand here today and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I really am. I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I've done that because I have come to know and rely on and practice living in the presence of God. You know, that man who slid that big book across the table and told me to get on my knees and try some prayer, he was one of my God squad. And he was the one that made sure that my spiritual life deepened while I was in his presence. And every single story he told me was stories about how he had watched God work in the lives of his fellows and how God had worked in his life so that I could build a frame of reference, so I could build a frame of reference for bad things happening and people relying on God to get through them. And I spent, over the years, I had abandoned myself to God, and I had turned over, you know, every area of my life to God, you know, a little bit at a time. You know, surrender is a process, it's not an event. And so I had been just abandoning myself to God and giving him all of these pieces and parts. And I'd given him every area. I'd given him, you know, school and work and all kinds of relationships and my family. And I had learned how, you know, to let go and let God and turn things over. And you know, everything that I gave God got better. Absolutely everything that I gave over to God got better. I kept one area all for myself, and that area was boys. I decided that God probably didn't know what handsome was, so I was going to take care of that. And my life looked like I was the one that was running that, because you know I had you know lots of boyfriends. You know, at one point I got married and divorced in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're bored in your home group, I'd suggest that. Gets everybody riled up and people pick sides, and it's, you know, it's just, it's great entertainment for a while. But anyway, I was running this whole thing myself, and I had this man who had come into my life. His name was Lee, and he was a major in the Marine Corps. He was an infantry officer, and he was 6'1" and had broad shoulders, a big farm guy from Oklahoma. And he had a razor-shaved head and blue eyes, and he was just awesome. He was my best friend. We played golf together. We rode Harleys together. I mean, I just absolutely adored him. And I was doing my AA thing and going to my meetings and, you know, praying and, you know, it just, I mean, everything in life was just working really, really well. He had no relationship with God, but that's okay. I was spiritual enough for both of us. And God came knocking one day, and God would not leave me alone. He was coming at me from all different sides, and the message I kept getting through all these different venues was that I want a deeper relationship with you, and you're blocking me. Hey, Deb, I have perfect love to give you. You're settling for good enough when I have the best. Deepen your relationship with me. Come to me in new ways. And I heard him, and I said, no. No. I knew this was the only thing that I was holding out for my very own, and I did not want to give it up. And he kept coming and coming and coming, I mean, just from every different direction. And I knew what he wanted me to do. I did. I had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 17, 18 years at this point, and I was like, I got this. You know, I go to lots of meetings. I have service positions. I'm sponsoring people. I'm traveling and talking. Like, I got this. God, life is really good. And have you seen him? He's not a distraction. Look at him. Well, he's a little distracting, but that's just because he's handsome. But no, I'm not. And God kept coming over and over and over. And he said, you are again relying on man for the things you should be relying on me for. And I was like, oh, come on. And the only place I was comfortable was when I was on my knees in prayer and meditation. I was unable to work with a clear head. I was unable to do anything with a clear head. On my knees in prayer, meditation was the only place I was comfortable, and God was just relentless with me. And I had learned through the years that if I don't grow, I go. I had watched so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. When they decide to not grow spiritually, they disappear from Alcoholics Anonymous. They stop going to meetings. They distance themselves, and before you know it, they're drunk or dead. And so I know that I have to continue to deepen my spiritual condition, and he's coming after me. And I know what he wants me to do. He wants me to give up this relationship and focus on him. He wants me to join go join the Catholic Church. That's the thing that kept coming over and over and over. And I was like, no, I'm good. Really, I'm doing everything that you're asking me to do, but this is a bridge too far. And finally, he made it really clear that that was my only path. And I was speaking at the Louisiana State Convention, and I fell apart that weekend, just fell apart, just sobbed nonstop. When I got home from that convention, a man had entered my life down there. His name was Walter, and he's from Houston, Texas, one of their old-timers down there. And he had delivered the final blow to me. And I went home from that convention. I went to dinner with Lee that next night, and I said, here's the deal. I have to go become Catholic. And what's more important than that is I have to be in a relationship with someone who has the same kind of love for God that I have. And you don't have any relationship with God at all, so I have to let you go. And he said, what? He said, isn't there another man? And I said, no other man. I'm going to go become Catholic, and you're a distraction. I've begun to rely on you for the things I'm supposed to rely on him for. And if I don't grow, I go. I got to go do this. And so we broke up. And I cried every day for a couple of months because I just absolutely adored him. And I went and I sat down with the priest and I was like, okay, here's the deal. I'm here, sprinkle me, dunk me, do whatever it is we gotta do. I have just left this incredible relationship. I'm all in. I'm deepening my relationship with God, and I guess I'm supposed to come hang out with you people. And he was like, well, I think it's going to take a while. And so we started on this journey of having me become Catholic. So we're walking through that entire process. And what I don't know is that Lee left that dinner. He went and sat down with his battalion chaplain. And he said, Chaps, Deb left me. And the chaplain said, man, what'd you do? And he said, she's going to become Catholic. And she said that she can't be in a relationship with someone who doesn't love God the way she does. What am I supposed to do? And the chaplain said, man, I think Deb's pretty great. I think I'd go to Mass if I were you. And so Lee came and found me one night, and he and I joined the Catholic Church together. And what that did was it enabled us to have a faith journey that was the same, so that we learned a spiritual language, and we put that in the middle of our relationship, and we started praying together and going to church together and doing all those things. You see, he was not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so he didn't have our language. And so he and I joined the church together, and then we got married. And shortly after we got married, he left to go to Iraq. And what I didn't know is that when he left to go to Iraq, I needed to have a spiritual language. We needed to be able to communicate with one another. So when he would call me from Iraq, I was able to ask him questions like, how can I pray for you? What can I take to God on your behalf? How can I hold you up? And we didn't have that language before we became Catholic together. I didn't know that that journey was probably more for him than it was for me, but it absolutely was. And so while he was in Iraq, it was a dangerous deployment, but they made it through. They were living outside the wire in the streets of Fallujah. They were embedded with the Iraq army and doing some training, and it was, you know, a suicide bomber drove the car into the side where they were sleeping, and it was all of that stuff that you see on the news that was happening during that deployment. And what it did for me was it pushed me deeper and deeper into that relationship with God, because I had to rely on God with complete abandon. Complete abandon. The man that I loved almost more than breath, people were shooting at him on purpose. And there was nothing I could do about it. Talk about powerlessness. That's a powerlessness that I had never experienced before, ever. And I just had to stay plugged into that source of power that's constant. Because anything else that I would have tried would have been fleeting at best. And I started practicing living in the presence of God at that time. I practiced when I closed my eyes and I got on my knees to say my prayers. I practiced seeing and feeling God right there with me. When I would go to bed at night, I would turn Lee and his welfare over to God, and I would lay down in bed and God would lay down with me. And so I practiced living in the presence of God, and Lee came home from Iraq. And when he got home, he was a little different. There are things that happen to men and women when they're deployed to war that change their hearts. And so I started praying for the welfare of his heart, because I knew that there were big things going on and he may not ever come all the way home, and he certainly won't be the same guy when he gets there. And so he came home from Iraq and we walked through some of those struggles. And then his deployment to Afghanistan got moved up. He snapped in as the XO of 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines. And they went off to Afghanistan. And that means he's essentially the vice president of a 1,200-man company. And so they're over in Iraq, and it was, and to this day, it's been the bloodiest deployment of any Marine battalion in either of those two wars. He was losing men right and left. You know, he and I was his best friend, and so he was telling me everything, and he would send me emails, and June was such a difficult month for them that there were times when I didn't want to open the emails. You know, I opened an email one night, and it said, another IED, honey, nothing left but a boot. And I knew that he was changing, and all I could do was stay in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, stay on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, do everything I needed to do to keep all of this functioning, and rely more and more and more deeply on the power of God, and just rest in his arms. And Lee came home from that deployment. And there were 20 of his men that did not come home from that deployment because they were killed. And there were over 90 of them that were moved from the field of battle because of life-changing injuries. Life-changing injuries, losses of limbs, full body burns, all of that. You know, we stood bedside when one of the corporals from his battalion, a couple of weeks after they had gotten home from that deployment, he put a gun in his mouth and he pulled the trigger. And so we were standing bedside with his family when they took him off of life support. I mean, just big stuff was happening. And I just continued to rely on God and stay in prayer and rest in his arms. And Lee was finally, he was starting to come all the way home. He'd been home for a handful of months. And so he was starting to come back to me. We started to plan for the future again. It was just great. You know, because when they go to war, you stop planning for the future. And so we were starting to fire on all cylinders again. I was working for the Marine Corps at the time. We were working for on the same base. I called him one night and said, you know, I'm taking off. We'd both worked really, really long days. And he said, I'm right behind you, which means he would be at least another hour. And, you know, when you're married to people, you learn that kind of stuff. And I went home and I fell asleep sitting up waiting on him to get home that night. And I startled awake about an hour later and called his cell phone and he didn't answer. So I called the battalion. I said, has anybody seen Major Helton? And the captain got on the phone and he said, I'm so sorry, Deb, but Lee died on his way home from work. He was in a vehicle accident about a mile from the house. And, you know, there are going to be times, in my experience, there are going to be times in all of our lives where we're going to have to rely on the relationship we have with God, not the relationship we wish we had. And I'm so incredibly grateful that I had had those years where I was driven into a deeper and more effective and meaningful relationship with God when I was living in his arms and I was relying on him at all times. I'm so incredibly grateful I had those times. Because when I got that news over the phone standing in my kitchen that night, I lost my breath. And my immediate reaction was to begin to pray. And I said, God, I can't breathe. I need you. And it was and what I felt was I felt God come up and wrap his arms around me from behind like a lover does to their beloved. And what I heard in my ear was, I'm here. I'm here. Not this is going to be okay, this is just a nightmare, you're going to wake up and it's not going to be that way. None of that was going to be true. But what was going to be true was that God was going to be with me every single step of the way. My house filled up with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Colonel Reed came over and a bunch of folks from the Marine Corps came over that night. We sat up all night, you know, talking and consoling one another and all of that. And we're sitting out front. And I had sent out 3 text messages to various groups of Alcoholics Anonymous, one to my local group and 2 others. And I told Colonel Reed, I said, okay, here's the deal. What you don't know about me is that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober for 22 years. And he said, okay. And I said, as soon as that sun gets up over that mountain, what that means is that they're going to be coming. And he said, okay. And I said, and John, they're going to take over everything. And you're just going to have to let them. And he said, okay, all right. And I said, and they're a formidable bunch. And he said, all right. He said, well, does this group have a leader? I said, oh my gosh, yes. You'll know exactly who she is when she gets here. There will be no doubt. And the sun popped up over the mountain and 3 members of my home group came up. And I had warned him. I said, John, my people don't look like the people you're used to hanging out with. They're a motley crew. And he said, all right. And so coming up my driveway are 3 members of my home group. The first one up the driveway is my friend Matthew. Now, Matthew is about 6'3 or 6'4. He's an enormous human. He wears clothes that don't match on purpose. His hair was, it was either blue or green, I can't remember. And he has lots of piercings, and he always has this tie that's just ridiculous, and comes down to about there on him. And Matthew's gay, and he, you know, and so he prances a little bit when he walks. And, you know, and John's a career Marine, which, you know, like he can sit down, and when he gets up, his shirt hasn't even come untucked. And so Matthew's the first one up the driveway, and behind him is my friend Brian, and then my friend Sybil, who's sitting right over there, is the third one up the driveway, and they come in and they take over. They take over everything. And what happens is that Colonel John Reed gets to watch the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in action. The members of the Marine Corps who were there with me every step of the way got to be friends with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they got to be friends with the people who came from my church group, and everybody pitched in, and we all got through it. You know, there was a moment when a lot of old-timers were sitting at my kitchen table, and they were telling me that it was okay to be angry with God, and that when it came time, just go ahead and be angry with God. And I remember standing there, and I'm listening to them, because I listen to old-timers, and I do what I'm told, and I was listening to them, and I thought, there's got to be another way. Like, I don't want to be angry with God. God's my best friend. I mean, we've been through all kinds of stuff together. I don't want to be angry with God. This doesn't make any sense to me. And then my friend Walter, the old-timer from Houston, who had entered my life at that critical time, he called. And Walter was an old Marine, and he and Lee were big fans of one another, and he gets me on the phone finally after he gets through one of the newcomers who had my phone. And he gets me on the phone, and he said, "Darling, I love you, and I'm so sorry." And I said, "Thank you, Walter." And he said, "But God told me to call you right now and tell you that there are things that happen in this world that break his heart, and Lee's death was one of them, and that his heart will be mending with yours so you can rest in his arms." And I said, "Thank you so much for calling." And I hung up that phone, and I got everybody's attention who was in my house, and I said, "Listen up. We're not going to talk about being angry with God anymore. We're not putting anger between us and God. We're not going to do that, because there are things that happen in this world that break his heart, and Lee's death was one of them. And so God's going to be healing alongside us, and we're going to rest in his arms. Does everybody understand me?" And everybody in my house went, "Got it." And so that's what we did. We grieved out loud. When I had a bad day, I cried. When I had a good day, I didn't. But we grieved out loud. We stayed in community with one another, and we continued to pray our way through it. One of the older gentlemen in my group, he had just lost his wife. His name was Joe. And I hugged Joe, and I said, "Joe, what am I supposed to do?" He said, "Sit still and grieve now so you don't grieve forever. Don't make any decisions based on sadness or fear. Wait until that passes before you do anything." And I've taken that advice. And that's been 6 years ago now that Lee passed. And what I can tell you is that I sat in the desert up by Joshua Tree, and I healed. And I healed in the arms of God. And I healed in the arms of members of my home group. And they loved me until I was whole again. And then I moved to New Orleans. I got to relocate with the Marine Corps. I went to New Orleans, and I absolutely came back alive. I listened to live music every day. I ate all kinds of food that had butter running up to my elbows, and I came fully alive again. And then I got promoted, and I got to go work for the Marine Corps. My office was in the Pentagon for a couple of years. And I got to be humbled by greatness, and I got to work for some of the best leaders that our nation has to offer. And what I can tell you also is that God is incredibly faithful. He's incredibly faithful. He heals, he restores, and he stays in my corner, and he swings when I don't have the energy to do so. And I'm very, very grateful that when my day came, I had the kind of relationship with God that I could rely on, not the kind of relationship that I wanted. Because at some point, I got the message that God has perfect love to give me, and I was blocking him. And I believe that that's true for all of us. I really do. Look at the work we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We lift each other up. We don't shoot our wounded. We put each other on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we deliver each other into the arms of God. It's the most important work. It's the most important work. Thank you so much for having me at your convention.
Good job.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.